This production is brought to you by Magentrix. Magentrix is a pioneer in platforms for partner ecosystem management and partner relationship management. This is Partner Relationship Management, the ultimate channel sales podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Ultimate Channel Sales Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Bird. Fail hard, fail fast, fail often isn't a quote that we like to associate with partnerships. But some partnerships fail incredibly fast, some in as few as 30 days. Forrester reported, if a new partner doesn't start to market and sell your offering within the first 90 days of recruitment, they likely never will. What you do in the early days of a partnership sets the tone for the rest of the relationship, particularly what you do in the first 30 days. At the start of the partnership, it's important to be careful and leave first impressions that can help create partners who are confident in your brand, come forward for support, and want to promote your product. The attention you pay to partners during this critical time frame can result either in a positive outlook for a long-term partnership or can cause your partners to lose interest altogether. Today, we welcome a special guest to help improve your partner retention rates. He's a channel partner with a horror story that shows what not to do and shares tips for vendors on how they can retain their channel partners. Listen on to set a standard for retaining channel partners for the long term, discover what aspects of your partner program help and hinder your partners, and find out what truly motivates partners to sell more. Today's guest is a multipreneur with over 25 years of experience in the IT space, with a career spanning various roles, including project management, consulting, even a little stint on Wall Street. Today, he runs a managed service provider business, EV Software and Solutions, which serves startups and enterprise clients alike. He's here to talk to us about how not to lose a channel partner in 30 days, specifically on partner retention tips. Please welcome Adam Alfi. Welcome to the show, Adam. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Paul. Nice to have you here and actually get to listen to and hear and participate in this whole thing. Followed you for a little while. I've been listening to the past episodes, so it's nice to be on one.
Perfect. So tell us, what are some of the highlights in your career as a managed service provider so far?
It's really the angle of knowing that you're dealing with people, right? At the end of the day, your client's clients most likely are going to be the end user of the product that you're giving or the service that you're getting. So being able to see it from the other side and really try to make it better and know that you can make it better is the reason why I'm here now, obviously. Just taking that approach where we are talking about human beings, not the technology itself.
So tell us a little bit about EV Software and Business Solutions.
So yeah, we started as a web development shop for a while. We were a very, very small number. And then we actually started looking into the whole channel sales and partnerships, which really took our business to the next level. Possibly reason, some of the stories we'll probably talk about today. But from there, we expanded into the managed services business, as well as the managed outsourcing business, where it's not just getting individuals outsourced, it's really creating a team, an offshore team for that client where they are technically their employees, with the exception of name kind of thing. So it's being able to provide an offshore service to anybody, anywhere in the world at any time.
Oh, fantastic. So let's get into today's discussion. Why do you think the first 30 days are so critical when starting a new partnership with a vendor?
It's like any relationship, you really think about it. It's building that trust piece, right? Because it doesn't matter which end of the channel that you're on, you have to understand a couple of things. Both sides are going to make money. They're going to have to. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then it's never going to work. And don't get greedy on either side. Because as soon as you start giving the sense that you want more than you're willing to give, it's going to start breaking down. All that stuff you can smell in the first 30 days. As a matter of fact, I could tell you that you could probably sniff it in the first couple of days.
Oh, really? So when we first met, you mentioned that you had a partner experience that was a textbook example of how to lose a partner in 30 days. Can you take us through that experience?
Man, yeah. And since the last time we spoke, actually, it's now two, not one.
Oh, no. So,
yeah. One of them actually was going to start where we were going to resell licenses through them. They were going to be our distributor. And this was my first experience with that mistake where very, very quickly, as we were negotiating the contract with them, even before the relationship starts, and we're talking about 30 days, right? They tapped the customer to see if they can get the licenses themselves. So before we even sign paperwork, I'm already starting to see where this relationship is going to go. And automatically, there was no trust. And we ended up going with another distributor who just happens to be the biggest software distributor on the face of the planet. And we haven't been happier ever since. We've just been expanding with them tremendously. So this is also another thing on the aspect of the first 30 days. When we went to their competitor and we explained to them the situation with what happened with us, the complete opposite customer service of the onboarding process, you know, everything that really has a touch point in the relationship was done so right that we've been using them for the past 5-6 years and we've never looked back.
Oh, that's great. Now, you said you had a second example. So something's come up in the last few weeks that we've been talking.
So it has. And that also relationship has ended. It was also with a major software provider that's a SaaS product that's kind of exploding a little bit right now. And again, we were very, very happy with them at the beginning. And when I say at the beginning, the first couple of weeks, till we started working on the first deal. And then they started independently contacting the customer and negotiating on licenses.
Yeah, it's just they're jumping at a turn almost. Do you think these are just overzealous salespeople that don't respect the channel? Or do you think it's something else?
I think it's a couple of things. I think there's a bit of a culture change from the SaaS situation in general, where at first you relied on partners, but now you're big enough where you don't need them. And there is a little bit of lack of hunger from that perspective, right? Because if you think about the partnerships as you and I would know it, and the channels as you and I would know it, it was 110% mutual respect that you have this, I have this, you know, and there are clear lines of delineation on when do I wear your hat and when do I wear mine. And that's what helped us all grow, right? Mm-hmm. And then now those lines are starting to blur for a number of reasons. Let's take one of our partners that we're actually very, very successful in. And the reason why we're successful in is because it's a really good model of how it worked. We are a Microsoft Gold partner. We have over, I'd say close to 200-ish clients that are Microsoft clients, a number of licenses left and right, and we cover four continents at the moment. The idea of that relationship is that Microsoft understood that it's big enough that there is no way that by itself it'll be able to reach the small to medium business side of things. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge market that was untapped by that enterprise side. You know, never have you thought when you and I were growing up and we're getting our first jobs, you know, if you worked for a company that had Microsoft Office on their computer, watch out, that company has money, you know.
It's true.
Now you can, you know, if you're a 5-person startup for less than $100 a month, you could have a complete office suite that rivals enterprise with cloud and everything. But even with that aspect, it really happened because of the partners. Those are your local resellers, basically, that are in touch with that small to medium business market that is so hungry for that amazing technology that everybody worked with in corporate America. And now you can have it at your fingertips. And that was the driver of why Microsoft ended up eating a large part of the market share. On the other hand, if you start contracting into that and saying, okay, and you start getting a little bit aggressive and saying, I know the market, when you really don't, because you're too big, and there's nothing wrong with that. And you start getting greedy and thinking, why do we have channel partners and why do we have resellers? You start losing sight of what got you there. And eventually you start being labeled out of the market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that happening a lot these days.
And you don't have the relationships. You can be the biggest company in the world, but if you can't have relationships at a regional and local level, then you know that's not a scalable model.
100%. Even if you look at it from a personal level, I just purchased a car and I was looking at car insurance, and we had to change something in it, and it was a corporate insurance thing. And the biggest hassle, by the way, in the entire thing was, God, I have to call the insurance company. I don't have a dedicated rep. I'm going to have to go into the queue, and they don't know what the situation is. You lose sight of that. That personal relationship is more beneficial than that product will ever give you, because that's a trusted consultant that you take out of the whole equation, and it breaks down.
For sure. So here's a question for you. You know, some vendors, they look great on paper, but really that's where it all ends. And from your perspective as a managed service provider, you know, what are some of the things you look at that, you know, it looks like they're a good partner? And then what motivates you to actually getting involved and sign the agreement with them and start promoting them? Because it does take a little bit of kind of critical thought when it comes to looking at the company, the industry they serve, but then, you know, you're the one that has to take the step and invest in the business. So what are some of the things that you look for? What's your process of vetting?
Where are they now and how they got there? Meaning, if you're a startup, I consider myself a startup still with all these years, and I know the pains of going through it. So if you're a startup and you're trying and you're really pushing, I'm more inclined to help you because I know you're going to go out of your way to try to keep me as a client. I'm not too big for you. I'm never going to be too big for you. So you're always going to care about my business. I look into that. And the biggest other piece, honestly, is just like any consumer or any customer, I don't want to be sold to. I want to buy. I want you to tell me what you have so I could be interested enough to say, I want to buy this from you. I don't want to be sold an extra package. I don't want to be sold anything, as a matter of fact. And to be fair, if you give me your spiel and I don't like it and we move on, you got to understand that I've moved on. So if Absolutely. You want to build the relationship. Don't keep on trying to sell me. And that's critical for me, at least picking a vendor. I need to be able to relate to you. And it goes down back to that local feel. I need to be able to relate to you.
So let's think about from a vendor's perspective. You know, what are some of the things you think people can do that, you know, when they start the relationship, that the vendor and the partner can get on the same page from the beginning and start building confidence? You know, do you have any suggestions to vendors that want to make sure that they're getting it right from the start?
Be transparent on whatever the process is going to be from both sides. So if I'm coming to you and you have a service or a product that I'm going to try to resell to my customer for whatever reason, I believe that we vetted it and you have the best product, I need to be transparent with you from the beginning so you understand what deal I'm bringing on the table, and you need to be transparent with me on the other end in terms of delivery, because anything that you tell me, I'm going to trust you on until I can't. You understand my point? And that's going to break down the relationship quicker than anything. You know, a lot of people say that, and it's true, only errors are magnified. Those are the only ones that you hear about. But when things are going great, you don't hear a peep. And it's darn true. And all you need is that one amplified mistake to ruin a relationship. It's hard to gain that back. So being transparent from the beginning avoids all complications, I think. Because at some point, if I understand it's a mistake and we say we're sorry, at least I understand it was a mistake. So trust is 100%. It has to be there, and it has to be unequivocal from both sides.
So you got to start with the trust and the transparency. Agree with that 100%. Now, you know, as I read through Forrester reports and things like that, you know, a lot of what they talk about is onboarding. And they say, you know, if you don't have a partner that's engaged in, you know, selling your product within the first 30 days, they're never going to flourish. This is what the analysts are telling the vendors. And I understand that onboarding is really more of an ongoing process. Do you think it's realistic that there is some kind of result you'll achieve within 30 days?
Yeah, of course. Actually, you probably will achieve about 75% of relationship building in that first 30 days, really, because that's the base that you're setting, the baseline of the entire relationship. And the moment you fall from that, that's when you start getting looked at. So yeah, absolutely. It's all about user experience. Do I have the proper training into whatever process you're going to start involving me to? If I run into any issues, who am I reaching to? Not where can I call? No, who am I reaching to? all that stuff really is trust building, and it's a change, right? You're going through change, you're putting these people through change, and change kind of shakes things up, and everybody at that point, regardless of the situation, is going to look for safety. So as soon as you could blanket them with everything that they need to feel safe in the first 30 days, you have that relationship on solid ground. On the other side of the spectrum, you mess that up and you're done. An endpoint on the client side does not like you for any reason in the first 30 days. There is nothing that you could possibly do that will change that relationship at all. It's done. So you better believe that you need to be on your best behavior and give that best service, because that's the baseline.
It'll make it or break it. Now, in some cases, you know, the definition of what success is may be different from a partner's perspective as opposed to the vendor. Any kind of thoughts or best practices or recommendations you could have on making sure that kind of both sides are aligned with what a shared, you know, vision of success is?
It's a very good question, man. It's one that actually in my business, I've been wrestling with a little bit, and it really boils down to what's more important to you. Is doing the work important, or is the relationship with the client important? So you can't have both. If you're going to enter in a partnership, there is going to be one side of the partnership that owns that relationship, and there's going to be the other side that's providing the service that's lacking, and that's why you're hired, right? To fill that gap. Mm-hmm. And you just have to accept which side you're going to be on, because that is the line that cannot be crossed, because as soon as it's crossed, it's over. And by the way, it's over for all relationships. It's not like if I cross the line, you think you're still going to keep the relationship with the client. Sir, we've both lost that client, because now exactly. That client trusts neither you nor I. And that's a really key aspect here. Knowing where you stand in that relationship is key.
And losing it for both of you, that is a lose-lose situation. Nobody's coming out on top there.
Exactly. And it goes back to something that I think we mentioned earlier, which is, I think, greed. Don't get greedy in this relationship. This pie is big enough for all of us, folks. Everybody's going to have a piece. As soon as you start looking at mine, we both start looking bad.
Yes, exactly. So as you're kind of going through that onboarding process, obviously, you know, enablement and understanding the vendor's solution, you know, that is critical. But what process, like what's the best way for somebody to educate you and your team to make sure that the solution you're offering is really the best fit for your customers, right? That relationship is critical.
And if you really want to boil it into a basic example, it really comes down to the discovery.
Yeah.
Really studying your client, because speaking to the decision maker is one thing and they'll give you one certain story to an extent, but actually doing discovery and talking to the actual end users of the service or the product will enlighten you on a lot, many things. As an example, accessibility, whether if it's a service or a product. Sometimes management is not going to understand all the accessibility issues or requirements or needs that the team has or the end user has, but doing a proper discovery is going to enlighten you on a lot of these aspects that you have to take into consideration in your solution. Understanding the business vision is also very, very impactful, because that's going to end up giving you a solution that's going to mirror their process. You can't necessarily recommend a solution to a client without understanding what the end goal is, because mm-hmm. you're not building on the foundation that they're going on. So the client has to be very transparent with you there. Why are you bringing the system is a very good question, but what is your end goal as a business? What are you trying to achieve? Because that question is the difference between picking two ERP systems. One of them may be heavy on manufacturing because that's really your heavy process and it's not the end point of the supply chain, or this could be an e-com process and hey, that solution is completely different now and we have to architect it completely different. Obviously, I'm exacerbating a point to make a point here by saying, you know, manufacturing or retail. But really, if you want to look at it from a corporate America perspective, let's boil it down to a PMO, right? A PMO's job is to manage the projects and the portfolio and the program, making sure that things are adhering to a certain process. But as soon as you over-involve yourself as a PMO, you actually are going against the purpose of said PMO. So, so when I am brought in to kind of look at a PMO process, my main goal here is going to be, hey, are you doing this because you're getting audited and there are issues, or are you doing this because there seems to be a lot of slip in your delivery and we need to really take a look at scope now? How are you actually scoping these projects from the beginning versus what the end result is? So even from that smaller level where we're looking at departmental process within a company, discovery, discovery, discovery.
Do you think that a lot of, you know, software, hardware, service vendors, that they lack discovery as part of their onboarding process or enablement process?
There's a lot of people that think they do it right, and I'm not going to claim to be an expert either, because it's an ongoing learning process. But yeah, people will claim that they do onboarding, but you really don't, because at the end of the day, your help desk will suffer, and you have to understand from a transition perspective, that's your indicator. How is your help desk looking? Mm-hmm. People neglect to understand what really good discovery is, because it's, again, ongoing. And discovery is one of these things where it requires a lot of documentation, so nobody wants to do it, and no client ever wants to pay for it because they really don't understand the value of it. Until they launch a process or a program without doing discovery, then they understand how valuable that thing was. So I think there's a little bit of underestimation of it, or there's a little bit of delusions of grandeur where they do think that they've onboarded, but really you've left the end user in the dark most of the time. How to make that successful, I'm pretty sure there's some sort of metrics that everybody's trying to track, but really at the end of the day, it's really just trying to do the best you can. You know, we have people that we onboard for our clients as part of the MSP service, and I could promise you that it's a continuous improvement process. And as soon as you think you got it right, you've missed a step. Because I can guarantee you that every single onboarding process 3 years ago was a lot different than it was a year and a half ago, and is also a lot different than it is today. And we're just talking about a three and a half year span. You know what I mean? So you always have to keep yourself on your toes.
And it's been a wild 3 years, that's for sure. It's been a little bit different. So what about training as part of this? Are you a fan of one-to-one training, self-guided training? Where do you think training plays in the whole onboarding process, not only from a vendor's perspective, but a customer as well?
There has to be a commitment on the client side on whatever the plan is. If you're going to go the way of, first of all, let me just track back half a second by saying training is not just part of the onboarding process. Training is the onboarding process, because at the end of training, they should know everything that they need to know before they go in the wild, as they say. And that's from an end user perspective, but that's also from a customer perspective. So if I am the midpoint of selling you Microsoft Office 365 licenses for your company, it is my responsibility to make sure that you know how to use that tool. Not Microsoft's. No. So as part of my onboarding process for you and your organization to the tool, there has to be some sort of training. So from there, you start looking at different training strategies. There is the very famous train the trainer, where you gather, you know, your top minds in your company that you're going to train, and then these people will start coming into your company and training the masses. There is the one-to-one training, and then there is the regular training, which is kind of like your lunch and learns, or you're going to come to a classroom setting, or we're going to come to a conference room setting, and we're going to sit down, and we're actually going to train you. They all have their benefits. I think that it depends on your size. Logistics definitely ends up playing some sort of a role here. Meaning, if you're a company of 10 people, we could probably get it in a day or two where I could just send somebody and get it done. If you are in the 50 to 100 to that kind of realm, the train the trainer works a lot. Anything above that, you really have to come with a much better kind of like a university strategy, where it's going to have to be timed classes at a certain time, where you're going to have to give them remote and on site. There's a bigger strategy to that, but obviously it's a bigger deployment. I think that in my experience, there is nothing better than the one-on-ones or the one-on-fives, mainly because it's probably your best opportunity to actually get some hands-on experience as you are being trained from the trainer itself. And then you have a lot of opportunity to actually bring up some actual use case scenarios of your day-to-day job and how this would be beneficial rather than just try to blanket all these features on the system. That's a big aspect in training, by the way, that a lot of trainers don't necessarily realize they're doing, or curriculums aren't really surrounded around that, where I'm probably going to end up going to a training where I'm pretty sure I have, and you have, and everybody has, where they're explaining a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with the job that you're doing at all. And you're really wasting the time in the company of yourself and the resources of the company itself. So understanding departmental trainings or something that is a little bit more useful to what these people are doing on a day-to-day actually gets you more use out of whatever service and whatever tool you're reselling, for the simple fact of this actually helps them directly. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a huge barrier, I think, as big as you get larger and larger from the training perspective, you do end up missing that little piece. And that's an unfortunate side effect of size and logistics of in that nature.
So again, you're back to relationships, right? You know, if you have the one-on-one training, the one-on-five training, there's dialogue, right? You're able to build the relationships. When I did my VMware sales and technical sales certification, I did it all online. What's your opinion from an online training perspective or self-guided training? Do you think it's useful?
I think it's very, very useful. But I also think that having the ability or having the accessibility to that other human on the other side that you can kind of tap into for clarification, if you may. But I'm a big fan of that. In the last 3 years, actually, I think it's proven to everybody that not only can it be done, but the scale of how it can be done is just enormous. Take, for example, just university enrollments. Once really online classes and online degrees, even from known reputable universities, have been made available and made accessible globally. Just look at the enrollment rates. Just look at the amount of money, if you really want to look at it from a business perspective, that these universities made from students that have never stepped foot on their campus. It's enormous. And the opportunity becomes enormous because, you know, back to the accessibility point, you could hire me right now, train me on your product right now, and I could start selling for you right now. We've never met face-to-face. And if we choose never to meet face-to-face, it's great, but we still have a relationship and I'm still selling for you and I'm still studying from you, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a huge proponent of online training. The self-guided training specifically piece is really what separates the men from the boys, if you want to bring it that way. And the reason why I say this is because it really brings out the biggest part of what's going to make you a successful business, or how this relationship is going to succeed if we're talking from a partner perspective, which is discipline. You are on your own. Yes, this is a partnership, but it's a mutual partnership. For you to be expecting an outcome, you have to put some effort, much like myself. And that's where it gets harder. I will completely say this and go on record, and if anybody gives me flack for it, so be it. Anybody that tells me that an online degree, a real online degree, is easier to get, I challenge you. I 100% challenge you, because it's easy for me to stop a class dead in its tracks and ask a question that's burning in my head and get an answer for it and move on, then read for myself, try to interpret it for myself, try to research it for myself, try to reach for somebody. That's a lot of work. And by the way, that's a great characteristic to have, to be able to navigate and research and be scrappy and get the answer that you're looking for from trying to work for it. That also translates to success, because you're on your own. And what happens there is, if you add a relationship to it, and that other side of the relationship also puts in that much effort, that enhances that situation for both of us.
There we go. That's more of a win-win that we're looking for. Now, thinking about from a vendor's perspective, a lot of them provide, you know, sales, marketing content, things that are there to enable you as the partner. So what do you think some of that enablement content, what type of resources do you really want them to provide you? You know, I'm sure that you have no interest in 150-page white papers. So what type of content should they really be giving you to help enable you to sell their product?
I would say that for the most part, the big boys are doing okay from the content production standpoint. We work with Microsoft, but we also work with Software One as a vendor for software. And documentation is nice, but not white papers. But I'm talking about brochures, really marketing content necessarily. Mm-hmm. They do a good job of it. The small to medium sized business is actually starting to get very creative from that aspect. And they're really using social media to their advantage hardcore, which is fantastic to see. And that's a little bit of shift in a paradigm from a support perspective right now, because no longer is the support going to be, how do I get the product marketed? But now it's going to be, how do I continue to stay engaged with the product? So I would say that if you're looking from the strategy of how do I really keep that person engaged and what support do I need to give behind that, it's going to have to be run by somebody that can relate. The support from a vendor perspective now is all about fixing my problem that I have now. I don't want to go into a queue. I don't want to get a ticket and have a number. I need somebody that is instant gratification. You want to speak to somebody. How many times have you dialed the number, an 800 number to get support, and the first thing you do is just dial a couple of zeros to see if you can get a human?
Every single time.
Exactly.
Every single time.
Exactly. Now, that's the level of support that we really need to start shifting to, because on a vendor level, I'm looking for the same thing. You have to understand that if I'm reaching out to you and you are the owner of the service or the product, I'm reaching out to you because I have a problem right now. Not because I have a customer who has a ticket. My customer probably is going to be, if you're a POS service, this is actually a great example. And if my wife hears this podcast, she's actually going to be like, wow, you brought the story up. Last week we were in Florida and we ended up going to a restaurant in Miami and we're having breakfast. And the service was really, really slow because their system was down. And we ended up getting our food. We ended up eating. We asked for the check and we waited. Their system is down. And now people are starting to get a little bit annoyed because they want to leave, right? And I can't pay, only cash. Seriously, sir, who carries cash anymore? You know what I mean? Like, I'm ready. I'm taking out my phone and I'm ready to pay with Apple Pay even. Like, where's that credit card machine? Now, you're a POS system company or a POS provider, whoever was providing that third-party service to process their credit cards or whatever. If I'm calling you right now, or if you are the reseller and I'm picking up the phone and I'm calling you and I'm like, hey, Paul, I need help. Paul better have an insider on that other side of that channel to be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, Adam is screaming. He has 100 people that want to leave the restaurant. And he has 50 people that are waiting outside trying to get into seats, but they can't because the people can't leave the restaurant. I cannot wait. So we've gotten into the instant gratification and it's going to have to trickle down the service. I need a response immediately. Chatbots have been great in that until you figure them out. Auto attendants have been great for that until you figure them out. Social media right now happens to be great. The interaction that you get with brands on social media has been spectacular. I know that there are a couple of competitors of mine that use social media to their advantage, where they create private channels on social media outlets that give them direct access to their own customers on a channel perspective. And they could instantly chat with them and report feedback and even leave reviews that get promoted on social media, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the level of service that's happening right now. The next piece, whoever figures out first where the trend is going after this whole social media bubble bursts is going to be the winner, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And it is so true. When I've got a problem now, not in 4 hours, not in a one-day SLA response time. No, my problem is right now. And if I don't get it fixed right now, I might right now start looking for another vendor.
Right. Like I said, all it takes is one bad experience. 80% of consumers will leave a brand that they are loyal to from one bad experience. That's a staggering number.
Absolutely. So here's another part of a conversation that you and I had a couple of weeks ago. And that was just talking about things like registering opportunities with vendors, right? And it kind of ties into, look, I'm frustrated with this company. I want to go to another company. What is your thought? Because a lot of them use partner portals. They use different relationship management tools and things like that. Where's your take on, I'm going to share my prospects or my clients' contact information with you through a deal registration process? Where do you sit there?
Uneasy, always. And again, it goes back to what we spoke about earlier on the podcast, which is the trust aspect, right? I have to trust that you're not going to mess this up for the both of us, sir. And as a small to medium-sized business, every single client counts, every single one of them. You are never too small for me, ever, because my job is to facilitate the proper environment to allow you to grow to get bigger. So you cannot look at any number as small, and you have to continuously maintain to be hungry. But line of delineation, right? The trust aspect. If I give you that information, what are you doing with it? Are you really just registering the deal? And there are distributors that we do that with. We have built a trust, and I have to make you understand that I take very good care of my distributors. I consider them legit friends. I've flown to international vacations with. I've built actual solid relationships with them because there has to be that trust aspect. And like I said, it's uneasy when I give a client my client's information to somebody, but sometimes it's necessary to do business. And if the channel that you are dealing with or the product that you're dealing with is represented by people that have, honor is a really old class word, but have some sort of sales acumen, they understand what the relationship is. They understand that that information is gold that I just gave you. And the only reason why we should ever be talking about that information again is if you got this deal from somebody else that's trying to register it and you just want to call me to tell me how did you get it, you know, just to get a little bit more information on who gets the deal first. But beyond that, I am giving you my livelihood because that's what a customer is. It's my livelihood. I'm uneasy about giving it to you, but I'm giving it to you because I trust you.
The way that I always handled it in the past is that if I had one of my partners register or share an opportunity with me, and all of a sudden it came in through another channel, and now it's being registered or attempted to be registered twice, I'm going to call the first partner, let them know that somebody else is fishing in their pond. At the same time, though, if I'm getting an end user contact directly, the first thing I ask them is, who do you work with for hardware, software, services? And when they say, I work with this company, I pick up the phone to return one of the sheep to the flock. So, you know, that's the approach that I think that I've always taken, but I'm not sure that happens all the time today.
I think that situation is incredibly rare, and I wish that a lot of people end up hearing this and understand the agony of the reverse of what you just said, because it always happens with the bigger fish, right? It's like, why are you trying to fish in my pond, man? Like, let's work together. This is how we build relationships. This goes back to the first kind of story that I told you where, you know, how to lose a partner in 30 days, where even before we were negotiating something, technically, he's not my client, but I'm talking to you about it. You don't go and pick up the phone and think that that client is fair game. That's overstepping a line, right? I wish there were many people that thought like you, Paul. I really did, where they have that idea of saying who locally in that area that I know that I am dealing with that may actually enhance this relationship. And I may end up getting more business on the back end of it from Paul, because Paul has that relationship with that end client now, even if the deal wasn't Paul's. And by the way, Paul probably deals with a couple of distributors. I'm not the only channel that he's working with. If I'm throwing Paul a bone every now and then, guess where Paul is going to want to go to when they need a product or a service or they need some channel services and help? They're going to go to the person that keeps throwing Paul bones.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And we're coming back to the foundation of where this started, which is trust and transparency, right? If you have it, nothing else matters. And if you don't have it, nothing else matters. So in the vendors that I've talked to, one of the things that I've seen a lot is them trying to incentivize people to share client information, right? They offer gift cards, they offer spiffs, they offer whatever they can. Do you think that's a rational way or a good way for them to be able to spark some of their business?
Goes back to the question of what's more important to you? Is it the deal and the job, or is it the client? And you have to understand, where are you in that relationship? Are you going to own the client, or are you going to own the deal? And I mean, incentives will help. As they say, everything has a price. There's a whole multi-billion dollar market out there for buying information. So telling me that incentives don't work would be probably very naive, but it's also, it's a dirty way of doing it, right? Because you're basically kind of putting a price on a relationship that I either know will be worth more or not worth more. I don't know what the potential of it is. Or you're declaring basically that that relationship is worth whatever incentive you give me. So fine. Because again, loose lips sink ships. As soon as you give that client information to somebody else, you're basically giving them permission eventually to contact them. Now, people are going to say, but Adam, what are you talking about? I mean, obviously, if you're going to, for example, buy software from Software One to resell it to a customer, well, Software One's going to end up knowing who the customer is. Yeah, but I set the boundaries early. The boundaries are that this is my client. You are the pass-through. We're good, right? I am not giving it to you willy-nilly. There has to be that trust thing. And I'll be very honest with you. The moment that Software One turns around and calls my customer without telling me is probably the last time I'm going to do business with Software One, because at that point, I've lost the trust. So how much of that relationship am I worth to Software One? So far, it seems to be working fine.
Fantastic. And all of these elements, right, when it comes to onboarding, the building the trust, the relationships, you know, going through the enablement, the training, these are all usually elements of a partner program that a vendor will put together. What are some of the things that appeal to you when you start looking at different programs like Microsoft's partner program? And what are some of the things that just turn you off? You're not going to entertain it at all.
The ability to train staff is largely where most operational decisions get made, because business continuity is what I live and die for. It's what I make my living off of, making sure that business continuity for clients continues at all times as much as I can. So being able to, as a vendor, give me the support I need through change, right? Microsoft changes its policies, changes its software every 6 months, changes. But Microsoft is very good at giving you support in terms of communicating the changes, sometimes late, sometimes not. In situations where they know they messed up in terms of timelines and stuff, they'll extend the timelines to make sure that it's comfortable for people. So that's on a large license SaaS level. On a support level, if things happen in the organization that end up changing how the support is going to be supplied to an endpoint, these changes need to be communicated. Some people are afraid to communicate change because they don't want to rock the boat. But trust me, the boat rocking based on bad decisions is a lot worse than the boat rocking a little bit to try to fix a small hole. So early communication is key in terms of change. I look for a vendor that is willing to always tell me what's behind the curtains that's coming up, so I'm not surprised, so then my client is not surprised. That's a big thing, right? Because if your client's surprised by a change that you have not communicated to, both of you have lost the client, because that client is no longer going to trust me to give them any service or any advice or any product. And if it's Microsoft and they have had a bad experience with Microsoft products through me as the channel, well, wherever they go, they're going to be like, I just want Google. My experience with Microsoft has been horrible. And it was because of a channel partner that really didn't do their job, that wasn't communicative enough, that wasn't kept abreast of change to be able to educate themselves on these changes, because you're going to get questions on these changes from your end user. So a vendor that has some sort of a robust training program, vast communications. I have partners that actually kind of put out PR press releases, some changes that they have to some of their services. And it's stupid, but guess what? I have a Google scraper that basically goes and checks, you know, if any of these put out any press releases. And I'm like, oh, check that out. And then I go talk to whoever the department that affects. Hey, did you see so-and-so kind of? And that's communication. They didn't call me directly. I had to do a little bit of an extra legwork, but they've communicated that there are changes. So I am not surprised. So therefore, whatever is on that backside of that decision that's going to affect my end user, I'm already prepared with whatever the message is, whatever training that's needed that I need to provide because of that change, et cetera, et cetera. There's a cascading effect to everything. Yeah.
So you've shared with us some just great sage advice. So getting back to the topic today and to start to wrap up, you know, 30 days, how to lose a channel partner in 30 days, that's not a lot of time. And from what you've said, really time is of the essence in the partnership. And I think I already know the answer, but I want to ask the question anyway. What do you think the most important thing that a vendor's got to focus on to make sure you get critical success in the first 30 days? What do you think the number one thing they need to focus on is?
They need to focus on making the customer feel and understand and believe they are the only customer that you have right now that you're working with. If you could support your vendors in giving that warm and fuzzy feeling to the client, that relationship between you and that vendor is going to grow, and that client is always going to be with that vendor, and you've made him look like $1 million, so they're following you forever. Be there for your client, treat them like humans, understand their pains. Really, that's the key to the success between any relationship. Be there for them.
So if vendors follow the advice that you've shared today, what kind of results do you think they can expect?
Expect nothing. And it's a very pessimistic thing to think, but actually I'm going to flip it around. I'm going to make it very positive. I expect nothing, because you always have to be ready that you're going to have to do it yourself. That's number one, in one way or another. And then that sets you up to be pleasantly surprised. When the vendor actually does the job that they do and you are 100% satisfied, it'll be nice when you're pleasantly surprised and you tell the vendor that they did a really good job and you're thankful for it because they really believe it. And if a vendor does really help you make you look like $1 million, trust me, there's a lot of work behind that. That wasn't easy. That wasn't free. That wasn't effortless for them. There is probably a team of at least two or three people or more that are busting their butts trying to make you look like $1 million in that first 30 days. If you both share that real vision, that any words of appreciation will go so, so far. My wife does this on a consistent basis. She buys $50 Starbucks gift cards. And every now and then during some sort of, that somebody does, she works in sales. If somebody does something for her or a favor on her behalf, every now and then she'll just drop that $50 gift card. And that's built more relationship for her than anything else, because something very small, but it just makes the other person understand that you know that they put effort. They really did.
And that they're appreciated. Perfect.
100%.
So, Adam, I want to thank you for being a guest on our show today. If somebody wants to reach out, learn more about EV Business Solutions, what's the best way to find you and get in contact with you?
Well, the best way to contact me directly for the masses would be LinkedIn, Adam Alfi, EV Business Software and Business Solutions. Our website is E as in Edward, double F as in Frank, V as in Victor, ISION, efision.com. You can check us out there. We're going through a little bit of a rebrand, so we're going to have a lot of really interesting stuff coming up over the next 3 to 4 months on that site. New relationships, new partnerships that we've really, really matured over the last 2-3 years are finally coming to fruition. So really cool announcements there. And honestly, just keep your eye on possibly a lot of IT stuff that's going to happen on the East Coast of the United States this year. We're going to be very, very involved in a lot of conferences.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you so much, Adam. It has been a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you so much, Paul.
All right, guys, thank you for listening to the Ultimate Channel Sales Podcast. Please don't forget to join us next time. For more information, please visit channelsalespodcast.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode today, please leave us a 5-star rating. From the Apple Podcast app, just select our show, scroll down to the rating and review section, and click write review. And don't forget to share with your friends or professional network, anyone who'd enjoy it. See you next time on the Ultimate Channel Sales Podcast. This production is brought to you by Magentrix. Magentrix is a pioneer in platforms for partner ecosystem management and partner relationship management.